Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What did it take to track down and kill Osama bin Laden, and why did it take so many years? Many Americans feel they know what happened after seeing a fictionalized account in Catherine Bigelow's Zero Dark Thirty. But the true story told in the documentary Manhunt is equally compelling, and it includes interviews with the actual men and women responsible for identifying al-Qaeda early on and ultimately discovering bin Laden's Abbottabad hideout. A screening of Manhunt tonight at the Angelica Film Center will kick off this year's USA Film Festival with support from HBO, which debuts the film on its network on May 1st. The World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth is also part of tonight's event. Director Greg Barker joins us now to talk about the film. Greg, welcome back to Think.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So if you ask an American to picture an employee of the CIA, I think most people instantly go to a guy in a dark suit. And it turns out that women were really an essential part of this effort. Can you talk a little bit about the sisterhood?
Yeah, well, that's the main focus of this film, really. It's the there was a core group of analysts, most of whom happened to be women, inside the CIA, who began tracking bin Laden as a potential threat as early as 1993. It's almost 20 years ago. These women were the first, sort of first off the block, to see him as somebody who might be a threat to the U.S. They connected him to a lot of random terrorist attacks that were happening all around the world. They figured out that he led a group called al-Qaeda, and they were the ones that were warning that al-Qaeda was coming to attack the U.S. And they wrote these famous memos, you know, that were sent to the White House in the months before 9/11. Bin Laden determined to attack the U.S., and they were the ones who were then blamed after 9/11 for not having done enough. When in fact, they had devoted their lives to this, and ultimately, they were part of the core group that tracked him down in Abbottabad.
And as we'll hear here from Susan Hassler and Cindy Storer, they were well aware that they had a somewhat different approach to doing this work than some of their colleagues.
At that time, the people who had really deep expertise in al-Qaeda, they were women. And they did a job that at first did not make them very popular with their managers.
I was counseled once in a performance review that I was spending too much time working on bin Laden. They said we were obsessed, crusaders, overly emotional, you know, using all those women stereotypes. Men throw chairs, women cry. I ask you, which one is better?
Well, of course, that's a cut from Manhunt, director Greg Barker's documentary, which will premiere tonight at the USA Film Festival at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. I love that because they were obsessed, and it turns out they were right.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. I mean, that's one of the things that I learned just for myself making this film is, you know, it's easy to dismiss the people who are the outliers, mm-hmm. the ones who have the, you know, who go against the conventional wisdom. But sometimes they're right. These people were right. And at the time, you know, the senior managers in the CIA, certainly our national leaders, you know, couldn't imagine that a rich Saudi financier would actually end up running this global jihadi group that would then pose any threat to the U.S. Remember, this is right after the end of the Cold War. The mindset was still, you know, threats from nation states. If people thought of terrorist groups, they thought of Hezbollah as the mm-hmm. most serious threat. And so it just wasn't on the radar. And it was, you know, they felt like they were crying wolf, you know, but they were right. And it's just important. It's an important lesson to all of us. And what's kind of tragic for them is that they felt like the more they warned, the more they seemed shrill.
Mm-hmm.
And then were even, you know, dismissed more easily because, oh, well, you know, they're still warning about that, you know. Nothing's happened. Now, that did change some after al-Qaeda attacked the U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. But even so, between 98 and 2001, they still had a very hard time engaging the whole national security machine, not just the CIA leadership, but the top levels of the executive offices, the Pentagon, to really take this threat seriously.
So part of what the sisterhood was engaging in was this special skill set of pattern analysis, which sounds not very sexy, but it turns out to be really critical. Can you explain what that is? And I was surprised that it wasn't always like high technology that facilitated this.
Yeah, yeah. We think of the CIA often as the guy in the suit and really high tech stuff.
Right.
All of that does exist, of course. But what really fascinated me as I got into this is that a lot of it is incredibly analog, very tactile. I mean, it's like basic police detective work in a way. So what they would do is they would, you know, think, okay, there's been Osama bin Laden. Put his picture up on a whiteboard. There's this other guy, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Who's he? Put his – this is back in 93, 94.
Mm-hmm.
Put his face up on a whiteboard. Put all these other groups, faces, representations of these groups up on a whiteboard and just stand back and look at it. And they might make a pattern analysis tool, but basically what they did was put all these names in a spreadsheet and start seeing, are there any connections between these? Let's go back, look at the wall, look at the mugshots on the wall, and start drawing lines between them. And so that's kind of how they came up with a theory in their own mind that, in fact, there is this secret terrorist group that is run by this guy that is responsible for all these attacks around the world. And I'm talking about things as far back as Black Hawk Down, Mogadishu in Somalia, attempted attacks on the Philippine Air, things that are spread out around the world, the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, and connecting these different groups, these different people, all towards this one guy in the center. So literally they would sort of start with these names and faces all over this whiteboard, and eventually bin Laden's picture kept moving from the edge to the center, and they realized that all lines led to him. And in fact, he was leading a secret bureaucratic organization. That was Al-Qaeda, and they figured that out.
Of course, figuring it out and really explaining that there is a potential threat are two different things. And you were, as a source document for this, you were working with Peter Bergen's book. And of course, you bring us the interview that he did with Osama bin Laden in, was it 1997?
Yeah, 97.
Okay. Really an astonishing piece of work, and yet not a giant sensation when it was first broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, so Peter Bergen at the time was a producer for CNN, not well known at all, but he had a hunch that bin Laden might be up to something. You know, he didn't know that there was this group of women inside the agency who were had a similar hunch. But he tracked down bin Laden through various sources and ended up getting an interview with him, in which bin Laden declared war on the U.S. for the first time. And you know, he said something similar to an Arab language newspaper, but nobody listened. This was on CNN, shown around the world. But when you go back and look at the actual reporting, it ended up being a three, four minute piece, and you know, on CNN at the time, and it just didn't get a lot of traction in the public imagination. I mean, the analysts inside the CIA watched it, of course, and they're like, okay, now he's starting to actually say what he's going to do. But at the time, it didn't get a lot of play. But looking at it now, we show an extended period, a clip of it in the film, as well as outtakes and them sort of sitting around having kind of even, you know, light conversation together. It's really striking, bin Laden's commitment, the clarity of what he was saying. I mean, he didn't exactly say, we're going to do this, 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 but it was clear that he had big plans and wasn't really making, you know, any attempt to hide them at that point. It's astonishing.
The other thing that's really striking about that interview is that as a physical presence, bin Laden doesn't seem so scary at that point. He's saying really menacing things, but he seems almost shy, almost nervous in front of the cameras and very deferential to the crew that says, okay, just relax now. Okay, sit up straighter. He's doing all these things he's told.
Yes.
And yet we know this guy turns out to be capable of horrendous acts of violence.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting though, a lot of people who met bin Laden at the time all described him as polite and gentle, you know, very engaging, articulate, charismatic. He had a presence about him, and I think that does come across in this, in that clip. It's extraordinary. You know, I think, you know, if you look at his propaganda videos after 9/11, he becomes increasingly shrill and sort of looks more haggard. Mm-hmm. But this is, you know, before 97, and he was, you know, they were living in the cave somewhere up probably in Tora Bora, but bin Laden loved that. He loved that. I mean, he was from an incredibly wealthy family in Saudi Arabia, but he broke from that whole lifestyle and spent most of the previous decade in Afghanistan fighting the Soviets, and he loved all of that. He loved sort of long periods up in the mountain. He would take his kids on extended, punishing hikes through the mountains because he loved the outdoors genuinely, but he also wanted to prepare them for the harsh life that he knew was going to come once he really engaged the battle with the U.S. But he was in many ways a very kind of a man of simple needs. He was very content to have, you know, basic food, basic living conditions. And so in the interview, he seems kind of at home in his own skin. It's chilling. And Peter Arnett, who at the time, you know, with CNN was probably the most famous journalist in the world, ends the interview by saying, you know, what are your future plans? And bin Laden sort of smiles and says, well, you know, you'll hear and read about them in the media, God willing.
Yeah, the God willing part was, you know, it just kind of chills your blood.
Yeah.
And of course, bin Laden had come in and quite literally filled the void that existed after the Soviets finally pulled out of Afghanistan.
Well, he and the Taliban did.
And yeah. I mean, but they were recruiting, they were training people who had, you know, suddenly less to do than they had before.
Yeah, I mean, you know, bin Laden in the early part of the 90s was not in Afghanistan. He'd gone to Saudi Arabia for a time. And, of course, he famously, you know, when Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, Saddam went to the king of Saudi Arabia and said, don't bring in American troops to evict Saddam Hussein from Kuwait. Let me and my guys do it. We just kicked the Soviets out of Afghanistan. We'll help you. And, you know, the Saudi government sort of basically laughed him off and said, thanks for your offer of help, but we'll sort this out. And then, of course, 500,000 American troops come to Laden based in Saudi Arabia before that war, which is really what got bin Laden really upset, that as he saw it, the infidel had come to the Holy Land. And he was he eventually then broke with the Saudi government, went to Sudan, where he was living very openly as a sort of head of a construction firm. He built roads, working very closely with the president of Sudan at the time. And Sudan was kind of like a friendly place for international terrorists and their financiers. Hezbollah had outfits there. Carlos the Jackal was there, and the CIA had a station there as well that was monitoring all these guys. And that's really around the time that the sisterhood back in Washington was starting to pick up on bin Laden. This is the time that some of the operators out in the field were starting to notice what he was doing. But he was quite open about it. And he was there's a newspaper article from 1993 that we show in the film where he gives an interview to Robert Frisk with The Independent in London. And the headline is something like, you know, Afghan, you know, warrior puts his army on the road to peace. And there's bin Laden standing on a road that his company is building and now saying that, you know, he's given up the fight and he's a peaceful guy. When in fact, he was running the secret organization.
My guest is Greg Barker, director of the documentary Manhunt, which will premiere tonight at the 2013 USA Film Festival at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and will air on HBO beginning May 1st. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is director Greg Barker. His documentary Manhunt will kick off the 2013 USA Film Festival at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas and will air on HBO starting May 1st. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Greg, the team assigned to understanding Al-Qaeda was codenamed Alec Station. Can you talk about what was unique about the components of that team and the people collaborating together?
Alec Station was set up by the CIA in 1995 as sort of a virtual station. I mean, a station is a, you know, a CIA office in an embassy overseas. So there's a station in Moscow and, yeah. But this was the first time they'd set up a unit to focus on a single individual, and it was housed in Washington, D.C., and codenamed Alec, I think, after the son of one of the people on it. But really, it brought together the analysts who were focusing on this with the other side of the CIA culture, the operations people. Those are the people that we think of as, like, you know, the spies, although technically they're called agents, they're not spies, but they're the field operatives, the ones recruiting spies, doing the stuff overseas, and often they don't work together. You know, the analysts analyze what the people in the field, the intelligence that they gather.
Right.
Alec Station brought them together, which is now very common, you know, but at the time it was new, and it was really to kind of identify this new kind of threat. So it was first of its kind. But that doesn't mean it was always taken seriously by the highest levels, you know. But the focus really was this one guy. What's Osama bin Laden up to? Let's figure it out. And that's what they set out to do.
Is there tension within the organization between the people who process information and the people who are out in the field cultivating sources and managing that information?
Yeah. I mean, one of the main characters in the film is a guy named Marty Martin, who was a very, very senior case officer, later brought back to run the war against Al-Qaeda and the hunt for bin Laden. He tells his story for the first time in this film. You know, he's a kind of hard-charging, you know, case officer out in the field, speaks Arabic fluently. You know, a lot of those guys would look at the analysts who are mostly stuck behind their desk in a cubicle in Langley and think, you know, those guys, they don't really know what it's like out there. So there's a natural tension. And the analysts often think, you know, who are these yahoos who think that they're, you know,
big
the
egos,
coolest guys
right.
in the town. I mean, but that's a healthy tension.
Mm-hmm.
And but fundamentally, they have usually a lot of respect for each other. I mean, somebody who watched this film who is in a position to know said it was the most accurate portrayal of the culture and life inside the CIA that has ever been done in any medium. And that only came because people were willing to tell their stories. And they tell it, you know, it's, you know, not all of it's pretty and it's not all of it's morally clear cut. But they do stuff on our behalf,
yeah,
which we may disagree with later, but I tried to sort of shed a light on what actually goes into some of these very, very sort of complicated operations, morally ambiguous operations that we sort of expect our government to do, but we don't always know all the details of. And I tried to shed some light on that through the people who actually are living it.
I was really struck. You know, you talk about the moral ambiguity. I'm not sure what I expected, but even after they have accomplished this thing that we all agree needed to be done, the capture and the killing of Osama bin Laden, I shouldn't say we all agree, but most Americans seem to be in support of that having happened. They're not like high-fiving each other. There's still like this sort of sense of we've gotten this necessary thing done, but it was ugly along the way at times.
Yeah, it was a—yes. I mean, I had the idea to make this film the night of the Abbottabad raid for precisely that reason. I sort of did not feel the sense of jubilation as I saw people, you know, cheering outside the White House. You know, not that I didn't think justice was served, but I just knew instinctively, because I guess because of the life I've led over the past decade or more, is that this was a the end of a dark chapter, and I mean, in our country's history, dark in what was done to us, and dark in the road that we had to embark on to deal with this new threat, and it involved some pretty complicated, some ugly decisions that were made, and you know, we can all debate on about it now what it means, but what I always try to do in my films is to take a kind of humble approach. I don't really tell people what to think. I try to sort of make a film where the audience empathizes with the characters, even if they're the CIA officers who are the architects of the interrogation program, and ask ourselves, what would we have done if we were in that position? You know, because what also was really striking is that a lot of these people who were making the decisions, they're ordinary Americans. I mean, some of them have a military background, but a lot of them came to working in the CIA through all sorts of, you know, circuitous routes. I mean, one of the main characters, member of the Sisterhood, wanted to be an environmental activist and work on global, you know, women's issues. Another wanted to be a school teacher. One was originally going to be she had a PhD in ancient or medieval Islamic history and couldn't get a job. So the agency was hiring, and she ended up there. These are kind of people just like you and me.
And
in fact,
they look like
us.
Yeah,
they
absolutely
look like us. They're not the Jessica Chastains, or they're not the emotionally cold people we imagine.
Yeah.
They look like us. They're the people that you might see standing next to you in Starbucks, or they look like – one of them looks – for me, always looks like, you know, my favorite aunt. You might sort of meet for pancakes every once a month or so. They're just ordinary people, and yet they are making these really, really complicated moral decisions about what do you do if you have see a terrorist that – or you identify a terrorist who might be doing X, Y, or Z, and they're in a certain country where you can't capture them, or if you can capture them, what do you do with them? Do you put them in a black site? Do you strike them – you know, do you kill them with a drone strike? You know, these are all real world decisions that these people make day in and day out, and it's kind of extraordinary. And that's what I try to do, is just to get inside that world.
It was really fascinating to watch the section where they're discussing the sort of lead up to 9/11 and the warnings that were sent, but they could only be so specific by nature of the information that they had, and it's really a painful time within the administration.
You could say we're pretty sure it's going to happen, but we can't make that decision to say you should do or not do. We can say that our bottom line is it looks pretty dangerous.
The headline says Bin Laden determined to strike in U.S.
There were just warning after warning after warning all spring.
Well, you know, with the benefit of hindsight,
we knew something huge was going to happen.
It would seem that this was a perfect warning in August of 2001 that the United States was about to be attacked.
Everybody was completely tense.
Why didn't we do something about this?
The language being used by these guys was like, oh my God, what are they going to do?
And we heard there, first we heard the author of the famous memo that said Bin Laden determined to strike the United States. Then we heard John McLaughlin, one-time director of the CIA, and the woman after that. Remind me of her name, please.
Cindy Storer.
Cindy Storer, who we also heard of the clip in the beginning of the film. It does make you sort of sit back and think, with that information, what would I have done? What could I have done? What could anyone have done?
Right. I mean, you know, it's complicated, but I think that information was presented to the White House repeatedly in the months before 9/11, and it had also been presented in other forms to the outgoing Clinton administration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think was really, you know, at the time, the idea that, I mean, they knew where bin Laden was, roughly, but the idea that the military would launch special forces on a secret raid and to go kill or capture him, at the time was kind of institutionally unthinkable. Mm-hmm. Because of the mindset within the military. This was still in the shadow of Mogadishu. And it seems hard to imagine now, but there was a huge aversion to American forces suffering any casualties. And I think it was, and also at around the same time, the Attorney General, Janet Reno, had advised the CIA Director, George Tenet, that killing bin Laden would be illegal unless it happened by accident. And so it's easy to look back and think, well, they should have done something. And of course they should have done something. But I think the important thing to remember for history is that the intelligence was there. I mean, you know, they didn't know X, Y, and Z specifically, but they knew that these guys were coming at us. They knew what Al-Qaeda was about. They knew they were planning something big. The intelligence was there. What wasn't there was the focus of the national security establishment on this as a new threat.
Mm-hmm.
And that applies in both administrations. And I mean, I think, you know, 9/11 happened in the first year of the Bush administration. As often happens, administrations come in and they set their own agendas. It's just a natural process. And so although they had been warned by the outgoing Clinton administration that, hey, you got to take Al-Qaeda seriously, it didn't really, in my view, it didn't really sink in. It was probably beginning to sink in amongst some of the principals. But, you know, institutions take a long time. I mean, when President Obama came in, he reviewed policy towards Afghanistan for about 7-8 months. You know, it's just administrations do this. And so, but the intelligence was actually there. The failure was a failure of policy and almost of imagination, not of the intelligence.
And then when 9/11 happened, there was no doubt in the minds of anyone who had worked on this intelligence that this was Al-Qaeda.
Yeah. I mean, everyone who worked this issue knew immediately. As soon as the second plane hit, they just knew that instinctively that this was the big event that they had been dreading, waiting for. They just knew that they could tell from the chatter that they were planning something big. They didn't know what, they didn't know where, and then suddenly this was it. This was it. And, I mean, of course, Al-Qaeda or people affiliated with them had attacked the World Trade Center before in 1993, and they often go back to their targets, which they did.
Did they feel sort of thrown under the bus after 9/11 happened?
Yes. Yes, they threw. So, you know, there was a big investigation by the 9/11 Commission. But I think from the perspective of the analysts and the operators who had been working this issue for, by then, you know, close to a decade, they felt like the Washington machine turned on them and were looking for scapegoats. So, you know, and said basically, the famous phrase, you failed to connect the dots when the dots were there.
When I went to testify to the Congress, the first thing they wanted to know is, where is bin Laden? I went to the Oval Office a number of times. I was asked by the president, where is bin Laden? Everybody would ask the same question, where is bin Laden? It was very frustrating to basically have to admit that you didn't know.
That was Jose Rodriguez of the CIA in Greg Barker's film Manhunt. And he's talking there about the fact that once the world knew that it had been bin Laden, we sort of turned and said, well, go get him. And it wasn't that easy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It took, you know, I think for the first couple of years after 9/11, the CIA was really on its own, hunting bin Laden and basically dismantling Al-Qaeda and making sure that any other threats didn't come to fruition. We all know the story. I mean, he was clearly in Tora Bora in the months after 9/11. He escaped. He disappeared. He knew the area pretty well, and he went into hiding. And And I think genuinely they didn't know where he was for a long time. They were also focused on dismantling the organization, which is was the beginnings of – they had presidential authorization for this vast covert enterprise that involved setting up black sites, operating drones.
A function that the CIA had not had before.
There were predators beforehand. Yeah, I mean, there were predators beforehand, but they, you know, and at some point they put weapons on them. But it was really they began to really sort of take a military role because at the time the military wasn't ready for it. I mean, Rumsfeld may disagree, but the agency had been focusing on al-Qaeda and developing sources in Afghanistan for a long time. And so they came up with a war plan, which they presented to President Bush days after 9/11, which he then approved. Later, the special operations in particular got incredibly proficient and sort of had their own sort of revolution of how they operated and then worked very closely with the CIA, which they still do today. But at the time, initially, it was an agency operation. So the agency had to go from being an intelligence gathering organization that was constrained what it could do operationally and into essentially a counterterrorism operation that could engage in military activity. And that was a real sea change for the CIA, which has had a big cultural effect on the agency, which I think now we're still sort of – they're now asking themselves, do we want this role long term? And that may change. But that's what happened after 9/11 is they were told basically – the gloves are off. Here's new authorization. You go do it. And they were very careful to get presidential authorization for everything that they did. I mean, probably not every little thing, but for the broad strokes, they got authorization because they didn't want to be left out to dry because it had happened before. You know, with a wink and a nod from the president, just take care of this problem. And they didn't want that. They were, all right, you want us to go after this? We want it in
spell
writing.
Spell it out.
Spell it out. Interrogation, fine. Spell it out. Black sites, spell it out, which they did. And then they went and did it.
Craig Barker is my guest. He's director of the documentary Manhunt, which will air tonight to kick off the 2013 USA Film Festival at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas, and which can be viewed nationwide on HBO starting May 1st. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where you can design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, global studies, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Craig Barker, director of the documentary Manhunt. It will premiere tonight at the 2013 USA Film Festival at the Angelica Film Center in Dallas. Of course, Craig, a lot of Americans, both within the CIA and far beyond it, still have, moral questions about enhanced interrogation or torture or whatever you want to call it. I was really surprised by the interview that you had with a gentleman who does this work and talked about the primary skill that one needs, the primary thing you have to bring to those interrogations is empathy.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's Ali Sufan, who was with the FBI, who did a sort of landmark interrogation with bin Laden's former bodyguard a few days after 9/11, in which he got him to talk just through normal sort of interrogation techniques. Ali speaks Arabic, and I think, but I actually think that's true across the board. I think if you're trying to understand somebody, even if it's an enemy, you have to try to see the world from their perspective and try to connect with them on a human level. I mean, that's actually what I try to do with the film, is to, whether you agree with what went down or not, to understand that these are human beings who made difficult choices because at the time they thought it was the right thing to do. And I've spent a lot of my adult life living overseas in London, and I came back to the States a few years ago with my family. And one of the biggest changes in this country that struck me after having been away for so long is how little empathy we have for the other, for the people that we disagree with. You know, our political discourse has become so divisive. I just don't think that serves anybody. And so I try to, in the films, I try to be empathetic to everyone I interview, which I think actually makes them more honest and more open in their storytelling. And I think what he's talking about there with when you interrogate somebody is you have to try to understand where they're coming from. And even you know, Marty Martin, who's a CIA who disagrees with Ali Soufan about the interrogation methods, he spent a lot of time with these, you know, senior detainees, he speaks Arabic, after they'd agreed to talk. You know, it's a question of whether they were telling the truth or not, but they did talk. And, you know, then it's all about just developing a rapport with somebody and talking and just, you know, trying to engage on a human level. And the smart police investigators, the smart, you know, counterintelligence operators all know this, that you actually have to be willing to sit down and listen to those who you really disagree with to understand where they're coming from. That's why in the film, also, we show a lot of al-Qaeda propaganda videos, mm-hmm. more than I think has ever been seen by the American public before, because that's what the CIA officers and analysts were looking at. They had to understand the enemy in order to figure out what they were really about, and also al-Qaeda has a history of being very clear and direct in their propaganda. So if you listen to the propaganda, you get a good sense of what they actually are thinking and what they might do.
And yet for American politicians and political analysts and pundits, it's toxic to ever, you know, admit that you've done something like this, admit that you are trying to even understand why our enemies hate us.
I don't think it was always that way. I mean, I think, you know, presidents always engaged with, you know, would sit down with the leaders of the Soviet Union during the Cold War. You know, we might have big arguments and, you know, crises at the time, but there was a long history of listening, sitting down and talking to those who were our enemy. I don't know why that's changed so much now. I mean, I was in Iran for a month a few years ago for Frontline, and met with very senior members there, including very senior officials with the Revolutionary Guards division called the Quds Force, which is basically their secret operators overseas. They were the ones who set up Hezbollah. They were the ones who were attacking U.S. Forces inside Iraq. Nasty group of people. But I spent quite a bit of time with one of the senior commanders there because you can engage with them on certain topics, which gave me at least an insight into what they were thinking. And the other thing that's very interesting that I learned on that project is senior Israeli officials or senior Israeli intelligence operators sit down with senior Iranian intelligence operatives regularly, you know, maybe in a bar somewhere in Vienna or whatever. But I've had people tell me this who did it because they want to understand what they're thinking. And you actually find if they're professionals in that realm, they have a lot to talk about. And they might respect each other as a man or a woman. Of course, they might then also be assigned to kill that person. But they don't have a problem. People who operate in this murky world where the real stuff actually happens,
right.
It's not black and white. It's shades of gray. People who really live that, they know that that's how to get stuff done. Talk to the bad guys. Talk to the enemy. And try to understand them on a human level.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ed calling from Waxahachie. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Thank you so much for the opportunity. Appreciate bringing the story to film. I guess my question then resonates on how much the institutionalized thinking in the CIA will be changed because the sisterhood eventually will prove to be right. And if I could ask the director of the film, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 meaning that they've really learned from it, it wouldn't be repeated, and 1 meaning they'll repeat history over again. What's his gauge on that?
No, I think the institution has improved some. I think from talking to people who are, you know, who in a position to know their – but I still think that any institution has a hard time processing information that is outside of the conventional wisdom. I think that's human nature. But I think the appreciation for what these people did and how they did it is real, and I think it has changed. And there's certainly a lot of women inside the agency. I mean, there's a controversy right now. We read reports that the new director of the CIA, John Brennan, wants to put a woman, one of these key operators, we don't know her name, head of the National Clandestine Service, which is basically the number three position inside the agency. So that has changed.
Did you have trouble getting people to – it's one thing to even do an interview for a book. Was it challenging to get people to sit down in front of your camera and know that you could ask them about anything you wanted?
Yes. Yes. Look, these are people who are not used to talking to journalists at all.
Right.
I mean, I think if they have any contact with a journalist, have to report it and might end up doing a lie detector test. So for them to sit down and be open was not something they're used to. I had to spend a lot of time with them all beforehand to kind of get to know them, explain my approach. They watched all my other films, Sergio, Ghosts of Rwanda, a bunch of others, and to kind of judge what I was about. But I think obviously they have to be mindful not to reveal anything classified, and that onus is on them. The CIA had no official involvement in this project, had no say about what we did and all that. But, you know, the human story, the emotions involved, that's not classified. And that's what interests me most. And fortunately, there's enough stuff out there that we were able to construct a narrative with what's already been released and in sort of open source, they call it. So we could really just focus on the journey of these amazing, you know, characters. I say amazing, not necessarily endorsing what they did, but just kind of like saying these are people who've led extraordinary lives.
People you want to watch.
You want to watch, and they're compelling characters. And they made a decision individually, and then kind of word seeped out, I think, about what I was doing. And there was kind of a collective decision among some of this group that, okay, we're going to be a part of this. And they opened up.
So talk for us about the relative advantages and disadvantages of telling a story like this on film in sort of this 2-hour document as compared with long form prose in Peter Bergen's book about the same thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, Peter's book is called Manhunt is great. It's just coming out in paperback as well. Peter, first of all, he can talk to people and include information from people who would never go on camera.
People who won't be quoted.
Yeah. So I've got to get somebody to sit down on camera at length and really open up. The other thing is that I think the other approach is in a book, you can be more analytical, I think. You know, it's possible in film and documentaries. I used to make documentaries for Frontline, for PBS, which can be more investigative, more analytical. But I've sort of shifted in my sort of artistic journey to making films that work more as movies and that tell a dramatic human story, because I think it engages a wider audience. But what I then don't do is something, if I was writing this as a straight book or even doing it as a Frontline, I would have much more analysis of what this all meant. What does course of interrogation actually mean? Was it effective or not? Can we reach some conclusion, have some kind of reckoning about that? I don't take that approach in this film. I just find it's if people want that and that's important, that can happen elsewhere. I just want to engage with the characters in this film and let them tell their story and let the audience figure out what they think. So I don't claim to say that this is like all you ever need to know about this period in our history is in this film, but I would say that this is the best insights you're ever going to get about what it was like to be on the inside and what actually went down, told by the people who were there.
How much do you worry about people who got what they believe to be all they need to know about this story from a fictionalized account like Zero Dark Thirty?
Well, I mean,
you know what I mean?
I
like there are people who will see, people who will see only that, and there are people who will see that and then be curious and engage with other sources of information.
Yeah, I have to say what has astounded me making this film is how much interest there still is in this story. You know, The raid was 2 years ago. As a matter of fact, it's 2 years ago on May 1st. That's why HBO is premiering it on May 1st, second anniversary. There's been, you know, a lot of stuff written. There's the movie. There's an insatiable appetite, at least for now, on this. And I think we sort of go deeper than has been done before in this film. I think the movies that Zero Dark Thirty is out there, and it's kind of a phenomenon in the sense that it's contemporary history told as a fictionalized narrative, but that's still kind of partly based on truth. And so it's easy to kind of say, okay, that's what happened. And I think, you know, with Argo, for instance, the story of the CIA, that's like, you know, 30 years ago. And I think, you know, they kind of souped up the ending and the escape. But I think that's kind of, you know, we all kind of know that the movies do that. And that's fine. It was a great movie. Won Best Picture. I think with a story like this, it just is a little bit trickier because you're dealing with such an important issue that's so real, so recent, that it's natural for people to think, well, maybe that is what actually happened, particularly when it's marketed as the true story rather than just based on a true story or, you know, inspired by a true story. And I think that's kind of a blurry line that you know, I think maybe got them into a little bit of trouble because I know a lot about who they talked to and where they got that information. And I wouldn't say it's wrong. I would just say it's incomplete, very incomplete. So but as a movie, it works. As a movie, it works. But it's a movie. So I hope the audience can see the distinction. But, of course, you know, more people see Zero Dark Thirty than are going to watch a documentary, even one that premieres on HBO. We'll get, you know, a lot of people watch this movie. So I think we'll have a shift in the – But I think we will. I think the film, this documentary, will kind of contribute to a kind of a shift in how people understand that period.
Do you hope people come out of it? You say that you're not necessarily trying to guide anyone to think anything in particular, but do you imagine, we'll put it this way, that people will feel a little more respect toward the CIA than they have in recent years?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to say that set out to make a film that, you know, increases the CIA image, but I think
they're certainly more relatable in this film than they've been portrayed elsewhere.
Here's what here's the thing for me. I love spy movies. We all love spy movies. I think most of us. I love it. I've loved John le Carré novels, all that. But you can't just enjoy the spy movie without understanding the real dark underbelly of what that world is about. You know, and it's just like I think. When we go to war, we should see images of war, not just like video game images of, oh, hey, we got this, you know, look at how cool it is. We just bombed this truck. It's a nasty, nasty business. America is deeply engaged in the world. There is no pulling back. We are an international country. I spent most of my adult life overseas. We are engaged fully on every continent.
Got to jump in. We're out of time. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
Greg Barker's documentary is called Manhunt. It premieres tonight at the USA Film Festival and will air on HBO starting May 1st. Greg, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.